Okay, cool. Yeah. Hi, I'm Rose and I'm an addict and I am a child of incest and alcoholism, sufferer from PTSD, bereaved mother, and a person with tendency to eating disorders and a bit of SLA stuff in the background too. Yeah, I think the only reason why I never ended up going to GA is because I've carefully avoided those places. I'm an all-round addicted person. Yep. Okay, I was born to a middle-class, rather science-y, intellectual family about 2 weeks before it turned 1960. Actually, I think it was 2 weeks before it turned 1960, and in a beach suburb in Adelaide, in South Australia, which is the most Englishy part of Australia, you know, for anyone who's got familiarity with Australian accents and shit. Yep, that's where I'm from. And I just didn't fit. I just never fitted. Seriously. I didn't fit into my family. I didn't fit into my clothes. I didn't fit into my school. I just didn't fit anywhere. Never fitted anywhere, you know. Because drinking was the norm in my family, I had my first drink when I was 3 years old. And I sculled it and held out the glass to be refilled instantly. Yes, please. It wasn't quite as instant as I would have liked, but I succeeded in persuading them to come across with some more eventually. And I had my first suicide attempt at 5, and that escalated, of course, you know, continued to, like, you know, have suicide attempts. It escalated somewhat in my teens, yeah. I was an escapist. I was an isolated child, very, very isolated child. And I was an escapist, and I escaped mostly into books and to alcohol. Those were my big kicks. And by the time I was 12 years old, it was hell. Life was hell. I was getting beaten up at home. There were rapes. Now it says my internet connection is unstable. I'm very, very sorry about that. I was getting pissed by the end of lunchtime every day at school. I was getting pissed, you know, and I wasn't spending any money on food at school. I was just spending all my money on cigarettes. I didn't have to spend any money on alcohol because my family were into drinking so much alcohol. They had vast quantities at home, and I could just help myself out of one of those kiddie kind of like drink flasks, you know, every morning before I took off. Neat. Nobody even noticed. Take a little bit from this one, a little bit from that one, a little bit. Nobody knew. I tried to take some notes, but I probably won't be able to read them. Yeah, look, my suicidality by the time I was 12 years old, even though life was hell, the main reason why I actually wanted to help myself wasn't so much because my life was hell, it's because I had this over-responsibility sense that I felt awful about being part of a culture that that destroyed habitat, obliterated species, enslaved and abused, you know, indiscriminately. And I just felt disgusted by it all. I was kicked out at 16 years old. Look, see, my family were really, they were mathematicians and engineers and stuff like that, right? Okay, you know, like, as well as being drunks, of course. But I was a poet. I just always had my nose in a book, you know? I liked painting and drawing and stuff like that. There was nothing relatable. There was nothing at all relatable. Nothing at all relatable. The only thing that we had in common was the booze. Oh, and the red hair. and the red hair. We all had red hair. And all the genetic lines all the way down back both sides of the family all had red hair. So that was the one thing. So red hair and booze. That's it. And, yes, I just didn't feel like I belonged. And there's a show. It's probably not as familiar to North American folk. There was a show I got exposed to when I was a child, a TV show called Doctor Who. Okay, and Doctor Who had a TARDIS, you know, time and relative dimensions in space. I'm still a fan. Anyway, I would go to bed every night hoping that my bedroom would turn into a TARDIS. And then I would wake up in the morning and I would open that door and I would be on some other planet, maybe somewhere where I felt like I belonged, or even just someplace different. Just someplace different. And, yeah, it didn't happen. But I kept escaping. And when I was 12, I found other drugs in the form of, like, smoke and dope, cannabis. And was kicked out when I was 16. It was weird shit. It was weird shit. My family was weird shit. Because my siblings were, like, supported to go through university and I was kicked out at 16. You know, didn't make any sense to me, but it was just, I was other. I was always other, you know. I lived under a bush in the South Parklands in Adelaide for a couple of months, and I think it says a lot that I actually felt safer there than I had ever before in my life at that particular point in time. And even though there were some dreadful things that happened while I was living under that bush, it was still safer than it was being with my family. I discovered other hippies when I hitchhiked to Sydney, and in King's Cross in Sydney, I found other hippies, and I'd already been introduced to hallucinogens, and we took a lot more hallucinogens, and read Carlos Castaneda, and, you know, started hearing about Timothy Leary and all that kind of stuff, you know, did all that kind of shit, and then I decided that what I needed to do was to grow my own family. Oh yeah, I didn't mention, I had my first lover was a girl, another little girl, when I was 11 years old. Yeah, and so it was. I decided that I would sleep with dudes because I wanted to fall pregnant. That's bad. I wanted to grow my own family. I wanted to grow my own family. The family I was born to was fucked, and so I needed to grow my own. Okay, that's what I had to do. I had to grow my own family, right? Okay, you know, start again, grow my own family, and maybe I'll feel safe and I feel like I'll have some place that I belong and stuff. It's not a particularly good reason to have a child, I must say. But it was my reason, and I know for a fact that I am not the only young woman who has done that. I know that for a fact. And it took me a long time to fall pregnant. Damn. It took over a year for me to fall pregnant, and I went through this process, and I was always a bit. Isn't it quite amusing that guys could get pumped for information about whether or not they'd ever been known to cause pregnancy previously, very easily in the first 2 minutes of conversation, and not even know that they were being pumped. I thought that was very, very interesting, and Yeah, I did feel pregnant, and then I ended up at 6 months pregnant deciding to get married to the dude because he just wouldn't shut up. He just kept hassling me to marry him. And I got to tell you, that is an incredibly lousy reason to get married, to shut someone up. It's not a good reason. So not a good reason. That's what I did. And I left him 6 months later after he'd thrown my daughter at a wall. Okay. I ran away to Queensland, Far North Queensland. Stayed in hipping households until we were kicked out, because my kid just basically would never shut up. She just screamed all the time, and I wasn't a particularly functional person either, and we barely survived being stuck in a caravan during a cyclone. The cyclone had been cabled into the ground, okay, but it was getting buffeted around a lot, you know, in the cyclone. And because I got infectious hepatitis, and she was a screaming baby, and the caravan leaked, and she pissed, and I came in and out of delirium, and a really kind dairy farmer came along and rescued us and took us into hospital. And I mention that because the thing is that amongst all the insanity in my life, there have been here and there just dotted these really kind people. Not religious people. I mean, religious people would have quite often, you know, had charity and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, people who just basically gave a shit. Who just cared enough to give a shit. Every now and then. And he was one of those people. And, and so we survived. Amazing. So I didn't end up taking narcotics until about 1983. I had always had this perspective that you'd have to be really, really desperate to get out of it, to stick a needle in your arm, okay, to get out of it. I thought, because I didn't like needles, so I never thought that I would. I never ever thought that I would. I ended up with my liver so badly affected. I'd say not just from the hep, I think because I also picked up hep C from a government dentist when I was 19. And not that anybody knew what it was at that particular point in time, they didn't. By the time I was in my early 20s, I was suffering legendary hangovers, legendary five-day hangovers that were just unfreaking believable. And so it wasn't cutting it anymore. I mean, the grog wasn't cutting it anymore as a means of relieving my pain. It just wasn't working anymore. And so when a comparatively new girlfriend was hassling me for money because she wanted to score some narcotics, I went, okay, I'll pay for it just as long as you get enough for me too, you know. And that was it, you know. I was hell-bent. I wanted to find a way to feel better. And it worked. I felt better. Wow. Freedom from mental pain, freedom from physical pain. Wow, I'd arrived. I finally found the thing that worked. That worked. Far out, you know. Made it possible for me to function. I was quite impatient with other people who'd like nod off and scratch and do all that kind of shit because I'd think, fuck, you're wasting the fucking stone. How dare you? You know, I'd be kicking them and digging them in the ribs, and I was a pain in the ass. I really was. And but I felt better. I felt better when I was off my face. But it didn't last long. It only took another 2-3 years for the amount of heroin, of smack, skag, whatever you want to call it, slow it was for what, the amount that it took for my pain to be relieved was the amount that had me dropping with overdoses. So it just didn't take long. I took a nosedive really fast. I'm always fascinated. People who could like use for like 30, 40 years to stay alive. I don't know. I couldn't even make it four. I could not even make it 4 years, you know? But I guess I was a total pig for it, you know? And it wasn't that my definition of a good time was to just not feel pain. That was all I wanted, was to just not feel pain. So anyway, funny story. I got to NA, and because I didn't think I was an addict, right? I didn't think I was an addict. I thought I was a mess. I thought that I probably needed to be taken out. Okay, really taken out and shot seriously. But I didn't think that I was an addict. I just knew I was self-medicating. Basically, that's what I was doing. However, what I used to do to get by, because I was on a pension, I was a sole parent, you know, like it was times really, you know, everything was really tight all the time. I used to, you know, like run drugs for people, or, you know, take drugs here and there, or do childcare for working girls and all that kind of stuff. You know, I just did a lot of stuff for other addicts, you know, anything so I could get paid in drugs. Anyway, this guy rang me up, and he quite frequently asked me to smuggle drugs into him when he was in a detox, and so I was, you know, already mentally gearing up for that. And he said that he'd agreed to go to this thing, this meeting thing, and he actually thought it was a cult. He thought it was a cult and that he was going to be kidnapped and brainwashed and all this other shit, right? And so so he said that he would pay me in drugs if I went to this thing just in case he got kidnapped, so I could take down the number plate and, you know, tell his parents and all that kind of stuff. And so I ended up being paid in drugs to go to my first NA meeting. Now, that's pretty bizarre, isn't it? That's pretty wild. Yeah. That's pretty wild. And that's probably what it would have taken to get me there. And, yeah, that's what happened. Yeah, so, and I cried. I just cried a real lot, you know, because these people actually cared. These people cared enough to listen to me. They say, how are you? Like, they really cared. They really cared to know what the answer was, you know. They'd asked me to share, and I just burst into tears. I mean, I didn't stay clean for the longest time, but they knew it was okay to ask me to share because I would just say who I was and that I was an addict, and I just burst into tears. So it was fine, and I wasn't going to be taking up space, you know, having some drug-fucked rave, you know. I wasn't going to be doing that. Yeah, and it took me a long time. I didn't do a detox. I didn't do a rehab. I didn't do any of those things. I just kept coming back to the meetings. And in the meetings, again, I found kind people. Not all of them. Not all of them are really kind. Most of them are quite reasonable, you know. But a couple of them were really, really kind. Really, really kind, okay. And I kept coming back. And eventually I thought, after the death of a very close friend, who I had always thought of as amazing, absolutely amazing woman, sole parent, she'd run restaurants, been a junkie, traveled overseas, all this other stuff, you know, far out, you know. And she died, and I saw her son, her 11-year-old son at her funeral, and I saw what he was going through, and I recognized in a blinding flash, I recognized that my daughter was going to be in the same position, and she wouldn't have to work till she was 11. She would still be 8 years old, you know. And that given that her other biological parent was a pedophile as well as being extremely abusive, that the only thing I could really do to protect her was to stay alive myself. Fuck. Just so not what I wanted to do. So I thought, okay, I'll give it a go, what these NA people say. I'll try it out. I'll try this complete abstinence thing, which up until that point I'd not been willing to do. I'd not been really willing to try. And so I gave it a try, complete abstinence. And I put a time limit on it, of course, you know. And given that I was on a pension, it came in once a fortnight, I made it for a fortnight, okay, you know, right. So, on a pension, I'm going to try just not picking up anything for 2 weeks. Just for 2 weeks. If things don't get it better inside of 2 weeks, I know what I'm going to do. And things did get better. Only a tiny bit. Just a tiny, tiny bit. Just slightly better. Just slightly better. It was enough to keep me coming back. And I thought, well, if that's how much better things got after like 2 weeks, maybe it'll kind of like keep getting better like that, you know. Really. First year recovery, I reckon I used... I reckon chocolate was my higher power. I reckon that was the thing. I ate at least one family-sized block of chocolate every day. And I gained about 5 stone. I don't know how to translate that into pounds or kilos or anything, but it was about 5 stone, okay? I think basically a whole other human being, you know, substantial, reasonable-sized human being, not a little, you know, twiggy girl. No. Substantial human being. And so at 12 months clean, I went, oh, I really have to come to grips with this eating problem I've got. And so I started doing groups and stuff like that and went to another fellowship to learn a bit more about how to come to grips with that. But I kept coming back to NA. because this still felt like my home. It's my home. So, you know, I kind of slightly, you know, 2 years, two years clean. It occurred to me finally that I was a child of alcoholism and that maybe I needed to look into that, you know. So I went off to another group, but I kept coming back here, And started working that, started learning about the ism, you know, how it gets passed down the generations and all that kind of stuff. And even though that I saw my father as an ogre, a violent ogre, you know, that when I actually, you know, took out all the bits and pieces that made him look like associated with his alcoholism, I realised that emotionally he was about 3 years old, just about 3 years old, you know, and really had no idea how to function in the world. And went, wow, that's amazing. And then about five years clean, I realized that my relationships had been really super dysfunctional, okay, you know. And so I started trotting off to, you know, some other meetings. To do with my sex and love addiction, okay. And then at 6 years clean, the penny dropped that I had actually been sexually abused as a child. That's when the penny finally dropped that I'd actually been incested. And I drew the line on that one. I went, I freaking want to know. I am sick of this shit. I don't want to know. I'm busy. I'm studying, I'm being a sole parent, I'm doing lots of service, and you know, I'm working, studying, doing all the stuff, you know. I don't want to know. I so don't want to know. I don't want to go there. And so I avoided it. And things started coming unraveled because I avoided my stuff. That's the thing. That's the thing that I really got out of that, is that I really can't avoid my stuff. If I avoid my stuff, the thing is, I kind of picked up that was really only the by the way, you know. What I actually did was I tried killing myself, you know. I mean, along the way, I picked up a dysfunctional relationship. I dropped out of uni. I figured out I couldn't work anymore. I told my sponsees to all go and look elsewhere because basically I didn't have it to give away, you know. I stopped doing meetings because they stopped feeling like they were working, because I think it's because I wasn't able to be my authentic self, and so therefore I did not feel authentically connected to other people, you know. I think that's the reason why it started feeling like the meetings weren't meeting my needs anymore. And and I tried to help myself. So I did. I took a whole heap of somebody else's pills, you know, in the hopes that it would take me out. It didn't even put me to sleep. I mean, what the seriously, that's just so rude. But my sponsor said I had to start again anyway. I mean, you know, like if I was going to bust it, I would have been on something decent, I would have thought. But no. See, for somebody else's pills, I didn't feel any effect from whatsoever. And, and then I learned that I had to work on my stuff. I had to go into the interior world, that it wasn't all about the exterior world. It wasn't about trying to placate, I guess, my family with some sort of university degree, or you know, make the rest of the world think that I was a better person because I had a job, or you know, it wasn't about any of that kind of stuff. It wasn't about how I looked. It was about how I felt inside. What was really going on inside of me. It was about owning my stuff, owning my own stuff. So that is a whole other thing. And then I started looking at my ancestor. And wow, hasn't that been a journey? Far out. And then through that process of talking to other people, other women in particular, you know, with similar stories, I realized that I had been constructed as a victim by my abuser to keep me isolated, so that the story would never be told. My father, you know, like sexual stuff was fucking neither here there. It was seriously, yeah. Sorry, I keep swearing, I don't mean to. So that stuff's kind of near the here and there. It's all the other stuff that was done. It's the stuff that was done to isolate me. It's the way that my siblings were encouraged to bully and tease me, you know. It's the way that I'd be enrolled in something and then I'd be told. I was being told, you know, like the ballet. I was told that the ballet teacher had said that I danced like a little elephant, okay? And so, of course, I didn't have to go back to ballet school after that, you know? And I was told that Brownell, you know, I was enrolled in Brownies, and I was told that the Brownell didn't want me back, you know? I don't know why. I was probably the best behaved child in the class. I mean, I was what they termed a good child. A good in those days in a child meant biddable and undemanding. That's how I was. I was biddable and undemanding. I was definitely good, okay? But, yes, I was told that, you know, the piano teacher didn't want me back. Brownell didn't want me back. It didn't matter what I got enrolled in. It was always for a really brief period of time, you know. And I realised from talking to others that I'd been set up. I had been seriously set up for a really seriously gaslit and isolated and messed with, you know. And that whole stuff had imprinted on me, you know, that I believed that I was less than. I seriously believed that I was less than, you know, that I was worthless. You know, that's what I really believed. I mean, no wonder I was ever trying to take myself out. Of course I was, because that was the information that I was given. At some point in the late 90s, I had a realization as I was drifting off to sleep, some stuff happened, and I realized that one of the reasons why I'd been programmed to self-destruct is because I am the evidence. I am the evidence of what was done, okay? And the surest way to get rid of the evidence was to have me destroy myself. The surest way. Far out. And I realized that the most powerful political thing that I could possibly do was to survive in spite of it, you know. And and so I set about just doing that. Now along the way, because, and I blame my my childhood primarily for this. My daughter passed away about 23 years ago. She's my only child. Okay, only bad one. Certainly didn't feel like going through that process again. Anyway, so I only ever had the one child, and we were actually really close. We were actually really, really close, and she killed herself. She killed herself, and she killed herself over a boy. Okay. Who had killed himself, okay? And her whole obsession that she had with thinking that she had to be partnered and that one particular person had to be a partner and always looking for a guy to kind of like fix her and, you know, make her life right and all that kind of stuff. I realized that actually... that actually came from the shit that was done to me, the impact that that had on me. Yeah, so I had one more suicide attempt, okay, about 9 months after she died. And during the process of that suicide attempt, a thought occurred to me that had never ever occurred to me before. I was going out of consciousness, you know, from the gas, not because I was gassing myself. I was determined I wasn't going to pick up a drug again. You know, I wasn't going to lose my fucking clean time. I wanted to die, but I wasn't going to lose my clean time. Fuck. Yeah, so while I was coming in and out of consciousness, you know, like, and I got to tell you, gassing myself in the car with no drugs in your system, really, it's not a pleasant experience. Don't do it. Just don't. It is not fun. Okay. Yeah, I was going out of consciousness. Yeah, this thought occurred to me. Is it that I want to die? Or is it actually that I don't want to live? It had never ever occurred to me before that they're actually two different questions. They're actually two very, very different questions. Because if I want to die, well, that's the place I want to go. You know, that's got positive energy behind it. That's the place I want to go. But if it's that I don't want to live, then there's a bracket at the end of that sentence. That bracket says, because it's really, I don't want to live with things the way they are. And then I realized that I had to make changes. I had to make changes. And I was responsible for that because this program had already taught me. This program had taught me that nobody else is going to fix me. I'm the only one who can do that. I'm the only one who can do that stuff. I have to fix me. I have to take responsibility for that stuff. Yeah. And so that's over 22 years ago now. So I haven't had a suicide attempt in over 22 years. Now, bear in mind, this is someone who had a first suicide attempt at like 5, okay? Right? And my last one, I was like 39, and here I am. No, hang on. So it was many years ago, 49, I guess. Somewhere in there anyway, I don't know. I'm so not good with maths. Ugh. Still don't fit in my family. Yeah, so whenever it was 98 anyway. It was 98, okay? 98, 99, around there, okay? And so it's a long time. It's a long time, you know, and that's just phenomenal. That's an amazing thing. That's an amazing thing. And it does mean that I've had to learn to lean into the pain and also lean into the, because you know, part of the pain, all right, and this is where this stuff with kind people comes along, just random, good word, random kind people, okay, all right? This is the thing that, because the people who were supposed to take care of me did a really, really shitty job. Okay, when I was a child, they did a really, really lousy job. Okay. And I had all my expectations and hopes pinned on that. All right. But the truth of the matter is that besides all that shitty stuff, there were some actually rather kind people. There was a really nice chap who lived next door. I could always go over and knock on his door and just shoot the breeze and talk about anything at all. And he was always prepared to listen to me. He was always prepared to be there for me, you know. And there were a couple of teachers who were really, really nice. They were really, really kind. They really cared. There was the dairy farmer. There was the dairy farmer who rescued me and my baby, you know. When I was delirious and she was just sopping wet and smelly and screaming, you know, like, I mean, we weren't adorable people. But he helped anyway, okay? When I first got to the rooms, you know, like, the women who would pick me up and take me to meetings and take me home again, all that kind of stuff, I couldn't even get myself together to shower, you know, like my clothes were rotting on my body, you know. They were rushing on my body. I'm quite sure I stank, you know. And as soon as anybody cried, I'd be, you know, snuffleupagus with the bloody, you know, like the snot and, you know, everything else, you know, and crying. And kind people, just these random kind people, okay. And that's because I'm atheist, right? Okay. That's where I get the love that I need to stay clean, to keep breathing through the really dark and painful times, to do the amazing things, because I've done some really amazing things. Like, it's not just like, you know, that shit happened, like, it's been 20 years since then, right, okay, you know, since like, you know, death of my daughter and suicide, and I've traveled overseas, you know. I've traveled around Australia, you know, like here and there and hither and yon and, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, three times, you know, like I learned to play guitar in recovery, you know, like to write songs, you know. I get to be who I am. I get to be that misfit that I have always been. But you know what? Yeah, maybe sure I didn't fit in my family. Maybe I don't fit particularly well, like culturally, you know, because I never really wanted to support, you know, society at large, you know. However, I fit perfectly, absolutely perfectly inside my own skin. I like who I am. I don't necessarily always like how I feel. However, I like who I am. And my emotions that to me were the antithesis for me for so much of my life, I now realize are actually vital to my healing because they inform me of who I am, what my values are, what I need to do, what works, what doesn't work, you know. That's vital for my well-being. And yeah, I've probably talked way too long, and bored you all shitless, and thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to do that. Thank you.